2 years ago now, we spent several lessons in a series talking about idolatry. And it occurred to me to return to that because of some recent things I've been thinking about, things we've been studying about in our Bible class. And it occurred to me to ask the question, what makes an idol an idol? And the sermon shouldn't be very long. I've already found out the answer to that question. You spell it with an O rather than an E. And so it's idol, not idle. Now we can go home. Well, unfortunately, that's not the point of this question, but what are the essential qualities of an idol? What makes it inherently, essentially, in its very nature, idolatrous? And there are some obvious things about idolatry that should be really apparent to us, because the practice of image worship, certainly in our culture, our history, is something that is way a thing of the past. I suspect nobody here has a problem bowing down before an image, a literal physical object of some kind that they focus their devotion on. And so we say, well, that's just kind of a thing of the past. That's kind of the problem the Israelites had back in Old Testament times, or some pagan culture in the world today, but it's really passé for us. But of course, it was Paul who says in the two passages that are quite similar to one another, as is often the case in Ephesians and Colossians. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5, in a catalog of sins, he mentions covetousness or materialism, greed, which amounts to idolatry. And the way he puts it in Ephesians 5:5 is he talks about the one who is a covetous person. He is an idolater. So even in Paul's day, he was not as concerned with image worship as he was the root problem of what idolatry really is. And so it should be obvious to us. It isn't you have to have an image to worship, you have to bow down to it, and things like that. But what exactly does make it an idol? Well, one answer that I have frequently given in the past, and I don't think it's a wrong answer, but I don't know that it is a full answer, but an idol is anything that displaces God from His rightful place. Romans chapter 1, verse 21 is the verse that comes most readily to mind, because here Paul traces all of the root problem of sin of all of humanity, not just the Gentiles, but the Jews as well, to this fundamental problem of, although we know who God is, that we refuse to honor Him as God, to glorify Him as God, to use the literal term that Paul uses here that connects with some of the songs we've been singing. And so we refuse to honor God as God, to glorify Him as God, or give thanks, but become futile in our speculations and our foolish heart is darkened. And so, yes, Paul said this about those people, but this is the principle that is true of all of us. And Paul traces historically what happened with a lot of people who were so debased. When you give up on God, where else do you go? What do you turn to? And this is one of the most remarkable things that, people like to think of themselves as intellectuals, rational people, and they're too smart to think of, believe something stupid like religion. But you look what the outcome of is of that kind of rationalization, and you're driven to every kind of depravity, every kind of belief in false things. And you take the evolutionist just as an example. He is so bent on denying God can be a cause of the effect of the natural world around us that he will insist that life came from non-life. It just had to be. Do you have any evidence for that? No. And you're the rational person. You're the person that goes where the evidence takes you. That which is moral came from that which is not moral. That which is intelligence comes from non-intelligence. Without any shred of proof. But that's what you're driven to when you deny God. That's the kind of foolishness, the darkening of our understanding that results. And it also results in a depravity of character. That doesn't mean every skeptic or every unbeliever is going to run out and live a debauched life overnight. But that is certainly the effect that it has on society, because ultimately the message is there is no meaning in life, there is no purpose, there is no right and wrong, there is no law of morality other than just what is wired within our DNA. And so if you want to do it, why not? There's no reason not to. There may be practical concerns about, well, the state might lock you up or people might not like you anymore, but there's no real reason not to. And so Paul traces the problem of all sin back to this dislodging of God from the place of God. And if we're not glorifying God as God, then who are we glorifying as God? We have to make something the ultimate. We have to make something the meaning of life. We have to make something to be our central truth that we can bank on. And again, in one of the heights of absurdity, one of the things that people make their ultimate truth is, there is no absolute truth. That sounds like a pretty absolute statement, and it is. That's the one absolute truth they hold to. And again, what evidence do you have for that? Oh, none. I just insist that that's the way that it is. And so, what Paul was talking about in the people in that day still continues to be a problem now. Another thing that we might say is that an idol at least tries to, it claims, it pretends to meet whatever your real need is or whatever your greatest fear is, because our fear is simply that we will not get what it is that we need, what it is that we want. And so, will this particular thing give me what I'm looking for? And that's always the allure of any temptation. And that's why the Hebrew writer warns us in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 13, that we can become hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Not just that some sin is deceitful, all sin is deceitful, because all sin lies to us in two ways. It does not tell us what it will deliver. It doesn't even give it in the fine print. You listen to these radio commercials and you hear this great deal on you're going to get a brand new car and it's only $295 a month. And then the guy's done talking and at the very end they got hired this kind of all the legal stuff that's buried not in the fine print but in the garbled rush, because they don't want to pay all that extra money for all that legal stuff that no one cares about anyway. Just come in and give us your money and get a car. Well, sin doesn't even do that. And so it lies to us by concealing the truth, but it also lies to us, obviously, in promising us things it never delivers on. And you think back to the original sin of Eve and the garden, Genesis chapter 3 and verse 6, and what was it that compelled Eve to give up everything that she had in the Garden of Eden? Whatever concept she had of trusting in God, whatever concept she had of the relationship she had with every other human being on the planet. And we find it in verse 6, when the woman saw the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate. And that, of course, was exactly what the snake was playing up to her. Now, you may not want to eat this fruit because you think you're going to die. And that would be a real downside. Well, don't worry. That's not going to happen. So now let's consider the upside to this thing. You'll get to be like God. And you don't want to be left out of that, do you? What more could you want than to be like God? And God had certainly wired within Adam and Eve the desire to be like Him. It is God's intent that they become like Him, but not that way. And so she's going to take the shortcut. She's going to take the easy way, which is always the wrong way. And so she thought her needs were going to be met. And after she does, what does she find out? She's been lied to. And so sin promised it was going to fulfill her need, but did not deliver, but delivered something else quite different, and death did come. So notice in Isaiah chapter 8, we get a picture of this in the work of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 8, picking up in verse 11. For thus Yahweh spoke to me with mighty power and instructed me not to walk in the way of this people. So don't be like them. You've got to be different. And there's a message right there for us as God's people. If we're just the same as everybody else, how is our message going to be the least bit distinctive? How is it want to get anyone's attention. If we just say the same thing everybody else says, that doesn't mean we say something different just to be different. And there are a lot of trivial things that we may have differences about, like you might drive a Toyota and I might drive a Ford. Well, that's not a difference worth talking about, but there are fundamental differences that cut to the core of who we are, and therefore God's people are called to be distinctive. And in particular, in this context, what God wants Isaiah to be distinct about is how he lives his whole life. What is the center? What motivates you? What drives you in everything that you do? You are not to say, it's a conspiracy in regard to all that this people call a conspiracy. You're not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. You don't fear what the people of Judah fear. You don't fear what everybody else is concerned about. It is Yahweh of hosts whom you should regard as holy. He shall be your fear. He shall be your dread. He shall become a sanctuary. And one of those astounding contrasts that Isaiah offers is to say, in essence, God is a rock. And just as Nathan alluded to in his prayer, what you think about God as a rock doesn't have anything to do with reality. He's going to stay a rock. You might sit in the corner murmuring to yourself, God is not a rock. God is not a rock. And guess what? That won't change the reality of whether God's a rock or not. The only thing we have any control over is what of the nature of God's rockhood will impact us. Will God be a rock that we can take refuge in and he will be a sanctuary for us? Or, as he goes on to describe, he'll be a rock we stumble over. God remains a rock. But what that rock will do for us depends on our reaction to him. And you'll recognize this as being quoted by Peter in 1 Peter chapter 3. We're very familiar with verse 15. Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to answer any Bible question that anyone asks you. Right? No, always being ready to give a verbal defense for the hope that is within you by people who demand you justify yourself. They're not being polite or kind about this. They're attacking you. They're persecuting you because you're a Christian. And so what do? You consider Christ as the Lord that is holy. And if you notice verse 14, that's the other part of the passage that he has quoted. You don't fear what they fear. And so Peter was updating that and interpreting it a little bit and saying you need to understand that Yahweh of hosts that Isaiah was talking about in Isaiah 8 is none other than Jesus the Christ. And he is our Lord. He is the one that we set apart as holy. And he's the only one that we need to fear. And so we don't fear man. And of course the message in Peter is, you're going to be persecuted. So what? There's nothing to be afraid of. And what fear does is drive us to want to find some security that's going to answer that fear. Well, we have nothing to fear. The only thing you fear is God. But that we're not fearing God in the same way we're in terror of these other earthly things. But our right fear, reverence of God, is what will itself alleviate the fear and make it a sanctuary for us. But basically the message is, you don't fear what they fear. You're not driven, you're not motivated by the same things that drive everybody else. Those are not your concerns. You could care less about how much money you make, or how much popularity you have, or how much power that you wield, or how many trophies that you have, and whatever it is. How long you can live your life, how fast you can run, how much weight you can lift. The only thing you care about is, what does the Lord want me to do? What does my master say? And we submit to him. And so we don't fear the things the world fears. We're not driven by a sense of need for the things the people of the world need or craving, lusting after. And so you come on down to the end of chapter 8. And Isaiah says, to the law and to the testimony. That's his solution. We'll come back and talk about verse 19 in a little bit. But that's his touchstone. That's how do you know what the Lord of hosts wants? How do you know what it is that God desires of us? If we're going to fear the Lord, well, who is he? and what drives him? What is his essential nature? If they do not speak according to this word, it is because they have no dawn, no light. They're going to be living in darkness. We, without God, have no light. And we will pass through the land hard-pressed and famished, and it'll turn out when we're hungry, we'll be enraged and curse our king and our God as we face upward. We will look to the earth and behold distress and darkness and gloom of anguish and be driven away into darkness. You know, that's Isaiah's way of saying you ain't got nothing. You're driven by all of these fears, and because of the fears that you have, you're driven to search for security and all these things you think are going to solve your fears. Guess what? At the end, you're going to have nothing. It'll be like living in complete darkness in a land that is completely devastated. And so those are two valid points to make about idolatry. The unfortunate problem is that someone could come to that conclusion who simply says, well, idols are wrong. Or maybe even idols are not real. And God's the only real God that there is. And if you take that view, would it be possible for you to be an idolater still? Oh, well, surely not. Surely not. We wouldn't displace God, and we wouldn't be off seeking God to fill some need other than what He does. The problem is, it's kind of like when people say, well, you know, a lot of teaching done in the old days was, you know, you're in the wrong denomination. Let me tell you about the one true church. Well, there's a kernel of truth to what people are trying to say about that, but they leave the impression that your problem is you're in the wrong church. You got the wrong label on your church. And if you just come over to this church over here, it's got the right label on it, then all will be well. Or you think of it like brands. Coca-Cola. That's the only drink anyone ought to be drinking. For sake of argument, let's say. I know there's some people here who despise Coca-Cola, but hey, that's... I don't even drink it. Okay. We might say, oh, there's lots of brands of soda pop beverages out there, but Coca-Cola's the best. And so you ought to drink that instead of all this other swill out here. Or someone might feel so strongly about it, why, this stuff don't even qualify as food. There's only one, and that's Coca-Cola. See, that's how a lot of people would view this whole thing about gods. Yeah, there's lots of gods, but God, true God, He's number one. And so that's why you ought to worship Him, not these false gods. Or He's the only God. So you really don't have an option. You don't have a choice. And if a person believes that, would it be possible for him still to be guilty of idolatry? Well, certainly he could. Because the question isn't, what does idolatry do? It displaces God from His rightful place. That it pretends to meet our needs and satisfies our fears and give us security from those fears. But the real issue is, what is idolatry? And the point is that idolatry is really a tool that people use to manipulate their circumstances or their life or the spiritual realm, whatever you want to call it. That's what it is. That's how it functions. And that's why it is that even a person who believes that Yahweh God is the only God that there is can still be guilty of idolatry. Because if you start treating that God as a tool to manipulate for your own purposes, that you can just wield God around to your satisfaction to create circumstances in your life that are for you, and that, of course, is exactly what Israel was doing in our study we've seen recently in 1 Samuel. Let's take the Ark of the Covenant out to battle. This is going to be our magic talisman. We got God in a box. And we're going to take this furniture out there, and it's going to guarantee us victory. And it didn't. And that was just a one little microcosm of the greater problem that Israel had that will culminate in the destruction of the entire nation, the removal of her kingdom, and even the burning of the temple. And as we discussed in the class this morning, you know, God's point is pretty clear. You put your trust in the temple, you put your trust in the land, you put your trust in some king, I will take away your land and your temple and your king. And I'll take enough stuff away that you'll finally realize where your trust should have been all along. And so I want us to think a little bit about this manipulating of God. It's kind of magical, isn't it? Kind of like Harry Potter, you know. One of the things that always fascinated me about the Harry Potter stories is if these people are wizards and they can wield such magic, how come they don't change more things than they do, you know? It still takes so long to wash dishes. It still takes so long to travel certain distances, you know. Why don't they have better magic, you know, to eliminate a lot of the more mundane things in life and so on? Well, it wouldn't be an interesting story, I guess. But the principle is the same. By magic, you know, I can transform physical objects. I can change time. I can change the rush hour traffic, all to suit me. And that's really not quite different than what people want to do spiritually. It's not so much that we're interested in transforming things physically, because we know, well, you can't really do that without maybe just as much expense and effort and technology and science and so on to do that. Can't really change time yet, but, you know, science eventually surely will do that and so on. So, what does the Scripture say? Well, notice in Isaiah chapter 44, we see this idea of manipulation. Isaiah chapter 44 and verse 12, there's several sections in Isaiah that he likes to launch into some satire about idolatry. Here, the man shapes iron into a cutting tool and does his work over the coals, fashioning it with hammers, working it with his strong arm. He gets hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and becomes weary. He shapes wood. He extends a measuring line. He outlines it with red chalk. He works it with planes and outlines it with a compass and makes it like the form of a man, like the beauty of man, that it may set in a house. And surely he cuts cedars for himself and takes a cypress or an oak and raises it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a fir and the rain makes it grow. Then it becomes something for a man to burn. So he takes one of them and warms himself. He also makes a fire to bake bread. He also makes a god and worships it. He makes it a graven image and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over this half he eats meat as he roasts a roast and is satisfied. He also warms himself and says, "Ah, I am warm. I have seen the fire." But the rest of it he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it and worships. He also prays to it and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." You see the attitude of this person, how silly it is. You know, he's going out chopping a tree down to use for fire or for fuel for cooking. And the same kind of wood that he shapes and makes into an idol and bows down to it and says, "Oh, deliver me." You know, we're going to make our little tool by which we can manipulate circumstances, whatever the fear is. Whatever he thinks he's missing, whatever it is he thinks he needs to be delivered from, that's what he wants. Notice in Deuteronomy chapter 29, in verse 19, of course we've had a series of blessings and primarily curses if you keep the law, if you don't keep the law. But Deuteronomy 29, verse 19, "It shall be when he hears the words of this curse, he will boast, saying, 'I have peace, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart in order to destroy the watered land with the dry.' And the Lord will never be willing to forgive him, but rather the anger of the Lord and his jealousy will burn against that man, and every curse which is written in this book will rest on him. The Lord will blot out his name from under heaven." Well, what's going on here? Well, basically, the warning is, okay, we've got this list of curses, and here's an attitude of a person who says, "Well, let's just check these off. Let's see, not guilty of that, not guilty of that, not guilty of that. Well, I got nothing to worry about. Why, everything's going to be fine with me," even though inside he's just as stubborn and self-willed and evil as could be. What is his religion to him? It's just something to manipulate the circumstances of life. Here the problem is, am I going to be on God's good side or his bad side? Well, by staying away from these bad things, maybe doing a handful of good things, I got nothing to worry about. See, there's a kind of comfort he takes in that. And probably the most extreme example of this is in Jeremiah chapter 7, in Jeremiah's temple sermon. And you'll recognize that Jesus quotes this in the New Testament. But Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 4, "Do not trust in lying words, saying, 'This is the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh.'" Now, we noted before that when you repeat something in Hebrew, you say it twice, that is super-duper emphasis. And only rarely do you repeat anything more than twice. And there's only four times in the Old Testament that something's repeated three times. Most famous to us is holy, holy, holy. But here, it's repeated for the most superlative emphasis you can make, the lie that the people have believed that this building in Jerusalem they were worshiping at belongs to Yahweh. And we say, well, that's a lie? Can't be a lie. Well, look at the sign out front. It says Temple of Yahweh, right? It's got to be. God had commanded this temple to be built. It had been dedicated to Him. The great prayer of Solomon had been raised up over this temple in 1 Kings chapter 8. It's got to be the temple of Yahweh. So why does Jeremiah come along saying, oh, that's just a lie? Well, because how you treat it shows the real meaning and essence of that temple. And again, if it's just a tool for you to use to manipulate things as you want them to be, it's no longer the temple of Yahweh. It's just a tool of manipulation. It's a magic thing. Just like they had treated the Ark of the Covenant back in the battle with the Philistines in 1 Samuel 4. And so verse 8, he resumes, "Behold, you're trusting in lying words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, offer sacrifices to Baal, walk after other gods that you've not known, and then come and stand before me in this house which is called by my name and say, 'We are delivered, we're saved,' that you may continue to do all these abominations? Has this house which is called by my name become a den of thieves in your sight? Behold, I have seen it." And of course, this gets quoted in the New Testament when Jesus cleanses the temple. He says, "You're making the temple into a den of thieves." And because that's done in association with casting out the money changers and the men selling the animals, we say, oh, there's a bunch of thieving merchants. Yeah, they were overcharging people for all those animals or the money changing. And that misses the point altogether. Now, whether those merchants were honest or not is beside the point. A den of thieves is not a place thieves go to steal. A den of thieves is where the thieves go to hide from their stealing. They seek to find a hiding place so the police can't get them. And that's what the temple had become. We're going to go out and do as we please. As long as we make it back to home base, as long as we get back to the temple, kill a few cows, God can't get us. He may not be happy with us, but hey, God can't touch us. Because we've got the magic. We got the tool to manipulate things to our own selfish desires. And that's exactly what religion becomes to a lot of people, even the right religion. With the right name, with the right label. This is the temple of Yahweh. And we might say, oh, this is a church of Christ. This is a group of people belongs to Jesus Christ. Isn't that great? No. Not if all we're going to do is use it as a tool to manipulate magically in some way that we can rearrange the spiritual realm and bend the rules and change the decrees of God to suit our own purposes. But that's exactly what church is to a lot of people. Why do you go to church? Well, because it's good for me. Because if I do X number of good deeds, that's going to outweigh whatever bad things I've done. And on it goes. All of which are idolatrous answers. And so, once we understand this idea of manipulation, there are three things in particular that helps us to understand about religion and what's wrong with religion. First of all, you see this emphasis in the Bible about not worshiping that which is false or worshiping that which is true in a false way because we become what we worship. You know, you see this principle in the 115th Psalm. We've recently noted that in our Psalm. You know, the idols are deaf and blind and powerless, and those who worship them will become just like them. Because in essence, we are making our God in our own image. We're using this as a tool and reshaping things, and magically, what do you know? The way we want things to be is the way we want things to be. And so we start fashioning a spiritual realm in which all of the rules are just the way we want. And God is made then in our image. And that also explains the second thing, which is why it is that we ultimately become the idol. You know, when Paul talked in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 5 that the greedy man is an idolater, is money really what he is worshiping ultimately? That he's just devoted his life and he's sacrificing everything for the money? No, the money is simply a reflection of his desire. What he wants and what he's going to manipulate and do in order to accomplish that end. Again, some people say, well, yeah, religion's got no use for me. I've got other ways I want to manipulate the world around me. And I'm happy with that, but there are some people who think religion is the way to go. Religion is the way to do it, and since most of us are religious folks, that's the thing we ought to be concerned about. Have I fallen into this category of a religious person? Maybe I've even found the right church with the right name, but I'm still just using it like a magic thing to manipulate things to my own selfish desires. And so, ultimately, the problem is self. And we occupy that central place. And that again is what we see in Isaiah chapter 44 again. Notice verses 18 through 20. This is Isaiah's conclusion of that section. We were talking about how absurd it is. A man goes and cuts a tree down and he realizes it's just a tree. It's fit for burning. You use it to bake your bread or whatever. Oh, but you should also worship it, you know. Why? How can someone do this? How deluded can a person become? They do not know, nor do they understand, for he is smeared over their eyes so they cannot see, their hearts so they cannot understand. No one recalls, nor is there knowledge or understanding to say, I burned half of it in the fire and baked bread over its coals, and I roast meat over it and eat it. And then I make the rest of it into an abomination and fall down to a block of wood. It doesn't even occur to them. They don't stop and consider the absurdity of those two things that are pitted against each other and what it would mean. And so he feeds on ashes. A deceived heart has turned him aside. He cannot deliver himself nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? He can't even see it. It has taken such hold in his life. Because it becomes very difficult for us to say, hey, I'm greater than God. I'm number one. And so we have to cushion that. We have to kind of deceive ourselves where that's really what's happening, but we convince ourselves it's really something else. And we make ourselves blind to it. We become just as foolish as this man feeding on ashes. And then that brings us to the final point of all of this, and that's why God demands total surrender. God will accept nothing other than that. God doesn't say, hey, I'm the only God there is, so worship me. Or I'm the best God that there is, so worship me. Because if that was all there was to it, then, well, anybody that's worshiping the one true God, well, they got it made. They can't be guilty of idolatry. But no, you start treating God with contempt. You start taking him for granted. You have this attitude that, well, I'm going to stay within the boundaries. I'm going to mark off the checklist, whatever God's given to me. I'm going to do these things because God said do them. And I'm going to stay away from these things because God said stay away from them. And if you could just do that, then on their judgment, God would have to say, man, you know, you're really one sorry person. I hate your attitude, but you've checked everything on the list. I got to let you in. Because what God demands of us is to renounce this very attitude of manipulation to begin with. As long as we think it's about us, as long as we think we have some power and say in this, anything other than I throw myself in humility at the feet of my Lord and Master, and I'm ready to submit myself fully to your will, We are guilty of idolatry. If you come to Jesus because Jesus is going to give you a better life, that's idolatry. You come to Jesus because you've learned what it is to trust in Him and to love Him and glorify Him. And of course, in practical terms, you're not guaranteed a better life. Your marriage may fall apart. You may lose all of your friends. You may lose your freedom. You might lose your life. Now, if you extend the perspective into eternity, yeah, we'll all wind up with a better life, all right, but that's not why we do it. It's not we're going to manipulate the system in order to secure our well-being. We're glorifying God and serving Him. And so any good thing can become an idol. Prayer can become a tool to manipulate the spiritual realm for our satisfaction. We could start having a sacramental attitude about the Lord's Supper, as Nathan mentioned a couple of weeks ago. You know, we've got to take the Lord's Supper. That's what it's all about. And by doing that, somehow, magically, you see, that's going to secure for me my salvation. For a lot of us, it's good deeds. We see ourselves, we're doing lots of good things, and that outweighs the number of bad things that I've done, or the one really bad thing I've done. That's basically what most people in the world think. That, yeah, most people believe in God, but they also believe that it's a system of just deserts, that if you're a better person than not a better person, then you'll make it to heaven. And so we even see our character as being sufficient. Yeah, we're not perfect. None of us would claim to be that. But it's good enough magic to secure the outcome that we desire. And whether it's the church, whether it's Christ, again, all of that can be turned into a manipulative tool. And that, to me, is the very essence of what idolatry is. And that's why we have no reassurance that we are innocent of idolatry just because we don't bow down before an image, because we go to the right church, because we read the correct Bible, because we claim and pay lip service to the right God. It really gets to the very heart of our attitude about what we do with this God, what our relationship is with this God. If you will, take your songbook and turn to number 738. 449, none of self and all of thee. Well, I would have thought the other would have fit fine too, but that's a good point. And so, as always, we want to reflect upon our relationship with God. Is it about self? And we say, oh, well, it can't be. I go to church. Think of what a sacrifice that is. Think of how much time I spend talking to other people, putting up with them. And that some of these aren't such great people, you know. And on, all the things we can point to as sacrifices we have made, but maybe we're just making those sacrifices to make sure our voodoo is right, to make sure the magic's going to work just right, to manipulate things to make them as we want them to be. But nothing other than throwing ourselves, none of self, and it's all about Jesus. He is Lord, He is Master, and we're ready to do His will in all things. And nothing other than that is acceptable to the Lord. And anything other than that displaces God as God. We refuse to honor Him as God and to give thanks. And it will result in us losing everything there is. And as always, if there's some way we can be of help to encourage anyone to study the Bible with you, to render assistance to you in being baptized into Christ, we're here to help one another to do just that. But let's think about these things while we stand and while we sing the song of encouragement.